Welcome to the AANEM podcast series, a monthly discourse on recent publications in neuromuscular and electrodiagnostic literature, featuring interviews with the authors and other experts, brought to you by the American Association of Neuromuscular and Electrodiagnostic Medicine. The AANEM welcomes your comments, suggestions, and questions. Email them to aanem@aanem.org.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sandra Hearn. I'm assistant professor of PM&R at Michigan Medicine. And it's my pleasure today to get to speak with Dr. Peter Vandenberg. Dr. Vandenberg is the first author of a recently published updated guideline, the diagnosis and treatment of chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyradiculoneuropathy, or CIDP. This guideline was created by a joint task force of the European Academy of Neurology and the Peripheral Nerve Society. It is in the second revision, or it is the second revision, with the first guideline having come out in 2005 and the first revision in 2010. This particular iteration was published simultaneously in the European Journal of Neurology and the Journal of the Peripheral Nervous System earlier last year in 2021. So I am eager to learn more from Dr. Vandenberg about updates in the diagnosis and treatment of CIDP. Welcome, Dr. Vandenberg. For a bit of introduction, Dr. Vandenberg is professor of neurology at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium. It's a pleasure to have you. Let me go ahead and start it. I understand the guideline is a second revision, and oftentimes when we revise, it reflects updates in our understanding of the disease or its treatments. So can you tell us a bit, Dr. Vandenberg, why was a new guideline needed at this time?
Well, the first revision of the CIDP guideline was published in 2010, indeed. Over the last decade, insights in the pathogenesis and the treatment have considerably increased. And therefore, a second revision was long awaited for. And this second revision of the guideline is the result of a joint venture between the EAN and the PNS. EAN is the European Academy of Neurology, and the PNS is the Peripheral Nerve Society. And therefore, the guideline is an EAN-PNS guideline indeed.
Excellent. How did the task force develop and agree upon the critical questions that would guide the literature search and focus of the guideline?
Well, for guideline development, the EAN now requests that we use the GRADE methodology. GRADE stands for grading of recommendations, assessment, development, and evaluation. And GRADE starts with the formulation of PICO questions. And PICO stands for population, intervention, comparison, and outcome. For all important elements to be covered in the guideline, we ended up with 12 PICO questions, 7 on diagnosis and 5 on treatment. And these PICOs are extremely important since they drive the literature search. And once all relevant papers are selected, data are extracted, evidence summaries are created, and then we are ready to formulate GRADE recommendations. And if there is not enough evidence, then these become good practice points without grading.
Got it. Thanks to the task force for doing this great work for our electrodiagnostic community. Let's talk about the diagnosis of CIDP. Should we be relying mainly on the clinical presentation to make this diagnosis? And what should be the role of electrodiagnostic testing?
Well, CIDP is a container concept for a heterogeneous group of neuropathies with as common denominator inflammation and demyelination. And the diagnosis is based on fulfillment of 3 kinds of criteria: the clinical criteria, the electrodiagnostic criteria, and supportive criteria. The first and the most important step in the diagnostic pathway concerns the clinical presentation indeed. If clinical criteria are fulfilled, the second step is electrodiagnosis. And if the electrodiagnostic criteria are also fulfilled, the diagnosis is confirmed. This happens in the majority of the cases, but if the electrodiagnostic criteria allow only a diagnosis of possible CIDP, then supportive criteria are to be used as the third step to upgrade the diagnosis from possible to CIDP to CIDP.
wonderful to have a systematic paradigm that we can apply. In your experience, what are some of the pitfalls that can lead to CIDP misdiagnosis?
Well, clinical research in recent years has shown that there are four main reasons for misdiagnosis. The first is non-fulfillment of clinical criteria or differential diagnostic exclusions that have not been done correctly. Second, electrodiagnosis is not always correctly performed, or the criteria are not adhered to as they should be. Third, over-reliance on spinal fluid protein is often a problem. And then the fourth element is non-objective treatment response. The misdiagnosis occurs mainly in the CIDP variants. For typical CIDP, it's less of a problem. Now, each CIDP phenotype, typical or variant, can have mimics which need to be excluded. I give just an example. Distal CIDP and CMT1, demyelinating CMT. So they resemble very much. And of course, you need other tests to exclude the diagnosis of CMT.
That makes a lot of sense. One of the things I found most helpful about the guidelines is depiction of the different CIDP variants. I think it's really laid out clearly for the community to use. Let's dive into that a bit more. With regard to CIDP variants, one of the things that stood out to me in the new guideline is that we no longer use the term atypical CIDP, and instead the guideline offers specific CIDP variants. Can you tell us a bit about that decision?
Yes, well, just let's start with typical CIDP. So this is a condition where there is symmetric involvement of motor and sensory systems. It's proximal and distal. It's in all limbs. And then moreover, there's a progression over at least 8 weeks, and there are problems with the reflexes which are decreased or absent. So this is the most common phenotype that was already described more than 40 years ago by Peter Dick in 1975. But there are other forms of CIDP which have been attached to the CIDP syndrome over time. These other forms include distal CIDP, which means that it is like typical CIDP. There is no proximal involvement. There's multifocal CIDP. There are at least two limbs involved, and the abnormalities are in the peripheral nerve distribution. There's also focal CIDP, where only one limb is involved. And then we have motor CIDP and sensory CIDP. And motor and sensory CIDP are also like typical CIDP, but in sensory, there's no motor involvement, and in motor, there's no sensory involvement. Now, we have decided to call these forms atypical at the time, but because each of these forms has well-defined characteristics, they are not really atypical, but they are just variants of CIDP. They are under the CIDP umbrella because of the common denominator of inflammation and demyelination. But for all these forms, also for typical CIDP, the etiology remains elusive, and the pathophysiology may be different.
That's very helpful. I think it's useful for us to think about that common denominator that you describe, inflammation and demyelination, as underlying CIDP and its variants. And I think the guideline cleans it up a fair bit to be able to say there's CIDP and its variants, as opposed to this nebulous domain of atypical CIDP. One question springing off from that point: are there phenotypes or diseases that some may have historically considered as part of CIDP or likely related to CIDP that the task force chose not to include as a CIDP variant?
Yes, certainly. So a number of neuropathies have been under the CIDP umbrella, to take the image again, until the pathophysiology was elucidated. In patients with distal CIDP, for instance, the presence of an IgM paraprotein requires to look for anti-MAC antibodies, myelin-associated glycoprotein, and paraproteinemic anti-MAC neuropathy is not considered CIDP because of the specific pathophysiology and also because of the resistance to treatment. Then there is CISP, chronic immune sensory polyradiculopathy. CISP has been considered a sensory CIDP variant previously, but we decided to exclude CISP from the CIDP spectrum because it's not a neuropathy. In fact, nerve conduction studies are completely normal. And this is because it is a sensory reticulopathy, leaving the dorsal root ganglions, ganglion neurons intact. But CISP appears to be inflammatory and demyelinating and treatment responsive, and clinically it resembles sensory CIDP, but we thought it was not really a neuropathy and therefore decided to exclude it from the CIDP spectrum. So the conditions which we have named autoimmune nodopathies in this guideline were considered CIDP because they are distal or even typical. But in these nodopathies, there are antibodies against paranodal and nodal cell adhesion molecules which secure the axon glia junction in the nodal area. And this leads to a detachment of the terminal myelin loops with dispersion of potassium and sodium channels, interfering with action potential generation and saltatory conduction. The consequence is conduction slowing and conduction block, but there is no demyelination and there is no inflammation. Together with the poor response to treatment, this led to the decision to separate autoimmune nodopathies from the CIDP spectrum. It is very important to recognize these because they do not respond to standard treatment, but to other treatments like rituximab.
Got it. So to summarize, DADS-M with the antibody, CISP, and autoimmune nodopathies are disorders that are no longer considered a CIDP variant. And so what we're seeing here, I think, is that our updated guidelines reflect our continuing and emerging understanding of the pathophysiology and what some of these disorders have in common and what sets them apart.
I want to say that it's an ongoing process because as time goes by, there will be other things that come up. And this is just the principle of having CIDP as a container term, where you can indeed do investigations and then find out what the actual, what finally the cause of the different forms is.
That makes a lot of sense. We've got to keep updating our containers as our understanding develops.
And updating the guidelines.
Yeah. Let's talk about how we establish a CIDP diagnosis. Another major change I noticed in the guideline was the simplification of how we note diagnostic certainty. In particular, we've moved from having three levels, definite CIDP, probable CIDP, and possible CIDP, to a simplification to just two levels, CIDP and possible CIDP. In other words, that category of probable has been removed. Tell us about the reasoning behind this.
Well, it has become clear that the diagnostic accuracy of the electrodiagnostic criteria for probable and definite CIDP is virtually identical. And therefore reduce the levels of diagnostic certainty to only two categories. And we have indeed labeled these a little bit differently, possible CIDP and CIDP. And why CIDP only? Because we thought it was good to abandon the adjective definite, since the absence of a diagnostic gold standard does not allow this.
Got it. I'd like to take a closer look at the motor nerve conduction study criteria with you. I know many of us have used the 2010 table in our own labs. I have it pinned up next to the computer for teaching purposes, and we've recently updated that over to the new set. With the merging of the former categories of definite and probable CIDP into one, what changes do we see in the motor nerve conduction study criteria when we compare the 2010 version with this one?
Well, in fact, there are virtually no changes in these criteria in the second revision. The motor conduction block criterion was negative peak CMAP amplitude reduction of 50% for definite CIDP and 30% for probable CIDP. And since, as I just mentioned, the diagnostic accuracy of these two categories is extremely similar, we decided to use the cutoff of 30% amplitude reduction in two nerves as a criterion strongly suggestive of demyelination, and in one nerve, weakly suggestive of demyelination. And this then leads to the diagnosis of CIDP or possible CIDP if the clinical criteria are fulfilled to start with.
Excellent. Notice the demyelinating criteria are specific around the tibial nerve. May I ask why?
Well, yes. It is very difficult to be certain about conduction block in the tibial nerve, as we all know, as electrophysiologists, and certainly not with 30% amplitude reduction, probably not even with 50% reduction. This is why we decided to not have tibial nerve conduction block in the criteria. But on the other hand, abnormal temporal dispersion in the tibial nerve remains as a criterion. We changed the criteria in the sense that we now require more than 100% increase in the duration of the proximal CMAP instead of 30%. So it's a stricter criterion.
I also appreciated getting specific numbers for the distal CMAP duration criteria component. That's something that I think is important in practice as well.
Yeah.
One of the other changes I noticed is that a sensory nerve conduction abnormalities are now part of the diagnostic requirement for a CIDP and some of its variants. What kinds of sensory abnormalities do we typically expect to see?
Well, indeed, we decided to include sensory conduction abnormalities, and we agreed that sensory conduction criteria should be an integral part of the electrodiagnostic criteria. Any sensory abnormality in two nerves is required in typical, distal, multifocal, and focal CIDP. But for sensory CIDP, without motor conduction abnormalities, either one of two specific criteria needs to be fulfilled, either sensory nerve conduction slowing of at least 20% or the sural sparing pattern. Sural sparing pattern, which means that the sural nerve snap, sural nerve action potential amplitude is completely normal, whereas in the median, in the ulnar nerves, they are diminished or absent. Now, since there is no evidence that these criteria strongly support demyelination, I mean, for sensory CIDP, they do not allow a diagnostic certainty of more than possible sensory CIDP. However, often in sensory CIDP, even if clinically it's completely sensory, there are motor nerve conduction abnormalities which may fulfill criteria suggestive of demyelination. And we have named this form of CIDP sensory predominant CIDP. It's really a lot like typical CIDP, but clinically there is only sensory involvement. But from a neurophysiological point of view, there really is motor nerve involvement as well.
That's great. In my opinion, bringing in the sensory nerve conduction abnormalities and being able to offer that precision and how those abnormalities align with the CIDP variants is very helpful and makes a lot of sense. Other than electrodiagnosis, what other studies can be used to support a CIDP diagnosis?
Okay, well, the diagnosis is based on fulfillment of clinical and electrodiagnostic criteria. If electrodiagnosis confirms only possible CIDP, then fulfillment of two supportive criteria allows to upgrade the diagnosis to CIDP. So this is not to be done when the diagnosis is already confirmed by clinical criteria and electrodiagnostic criteria. Now, there are four kinds of supportive criteria: response to treatment, imaging, spinal fluid, and nerve biopsy. Okay, so first, response to treatment should be objective. It requires improvement on at least one impairment scale and one disability scale. Second, imaging, that includes ultrasound and MRI. So ultrasound is new because in the first revision, there was no mention of ultrasound. Both are acceptable with the preference for ultrasound because now there are well-defined cutoffs for enlargement of upper extremity nerves, brachial plexus, and cervical nerve roots. The advantage of ultrasound is that it is not expensive. It can be done in the outpatient clinic, and more centers, this is being done in the electrophysiology lab, which means that you save time also. It's much quicker, and it is not expensive. The only main drawback is that it needs expertise of the examiner, and that is increasing more and more, but in many centers, it's not the case yet. So MRI can be useful to image lumbosacral roots and lumbosacral plexuses. And these are structures that are not really, that cannot really be examined appropriately by ultrasound. So the third supportive criterion is increased CSF protein. This can lead to misdiagnosis, especially in patients with diabetes, but also in older patients, because with increasing age, the levels of CSF protein go up. So it's something that may lead to misdiagnosis. Now, if the CSF protein level is very high, this may orient to infection or malignancy. And if in addition, the onset of the disorder is acute or subacute, it can be a sign of autoimmune nodopathy. And then you should look for these nodal paranodal antibodies. So the fourth supportive criterion is nerve biopsy. And this is a technique that should only be done under very specific circumstances. First, you need minimal standards for surgical expertise, processing and reading of nerve biopsies. And second, these patients should be in trouble and there is no or a very poor response to treatment. And this is for looking to alternative diagnosis, such as a nerve sheath tumor, sarcoidosis, amyloidosis, CMT, and so on.
Got it. Thank you. So there are four supportive criteria that we can use when we need to, when the diagnosis is not clear and when it may impact the patient's care. I have a question about application of that concept and potential implications. One topic that came up in discussion with colleagues is if in patients suspected of having typical CIDP, but who fall short of electrodiagnostic criteria, based on the new guideline, a diagnosis of possible typical CIDP could be made based on one, objective response to treatment, and two, at least one additional supportive criterion, then effectively we have a pathway for diagnosing CIDP or possible rather, absent the typical electrophysiologic abnormalities. Do you envision that this would lead to increasing invasive testing or treatment trials in patients who don't have CIDP? And what advice might you share with the community for considering when it's appropriate to take those steps when the patient falls short of electrodiagnostic criteria?
Yes, I agree that it was a difficult decision to include this, but we made an exception for patients with clinically typical CIDP who do not fulfill minimal electrodiagnostic criteria, but they do have electrodiagnostic abnormalities, of course, indicative of a neuropathy. And we did this to avoid that these patients miss out on effective treatment. If they show us objective response to treatment and fulfill one other supportive criteria, the dose diagnosis of possible typical CIDP is allowed, but is not upgradable to CIDP. So it remains a possibility. But if the patient responds to the treatment, then everybody is happy.
Got it. Thank you. Let's turn to treatment. Can you give us an overview of the treatment strategies that are recommended by the task force?
To start with, before you think of treating a patient, you really need to adhere to diagnostic criteria, and this is of the utmost importance. Treatment can be very expensive and can have significant side effects. And now the other point to take into account is that you should only treat if there is disability and impairment. And also you should only treat if there is active disease, which means that there is objective worsening of the patient's condition, which cannot be explained by axonal loss. Now, we distinguish two treatment phases, induction and maintenance. For induction treatment, there is a strong recommendation for each of the three proven effective treatment modalities, corticosteroids, immunoglobulins, IVIG, and plasma exchange. And most of the time, corticosteroids or IVIG comes first. And in patients where this does not really work, plasma exchange is being used. Plasma exchange works pretty well, but over a longer term, of course, it's not really very practical and you cannot do it in every hospital. Now, if you start a treatment and the first drug you use is ineffective, then you should reconsider the diagnosis. Even more so if there is no response to the second drug and again more if after the third treatment nothing happens to the patient. So it's really the treatments are ineffective. Then not only should you reconsider the diagnosis, but you should probably best refer the patient to a specialist center. There are also immunosuppressive drugs, and there is very low certainty evidence for any of these. But we advised to use some of these if nothing else works, and if you still think the patient has CIDP. And the choices we proposed are rituximab, cyclosporine, and cyclophosphamide. Then we come to the maintenance treatment. The same drugs can be used. It's mainly immunoglobulins and corticosteroids. The new item here is the use of SCIG, subcutaneous immunoglobulin. We did not advise or recommend to use it in the induction phase because there is not that much experience to get a good result on a short time lapse. And so therefore, we strongly recommend it also for maintenance treatment, as the treatment with SCIG gives the same results as with IVIG. Now, whether you should switch to subcutaneous immunoglobulin depends largely on the patient preference. Some patients like it, others don't. It's true that it's more technical, but on the other hand, the patient does not need to go to the hospital every 2-3 weeks. So it's more comfortable for many patients, also less expensive for the community.
Fantastic. That's great for patients to have that option.
When you start to treat and the patient responds, sometimes after some time, you get a complete response. Patient is perfectly well. What you then should do is to periodically decrease the dose or the frequency and stop to see whether the patient is in remission or whether the disease has become inactive. And if the patient then worsens, if you stop, then he has active disease, you should restart treatment. If the response is partial, then you should consider increasing the dose or the frequency. If that doesn't help, then you could also try other drugs, immunosuppressive drugs. And there we advise to use azathioprine, cyclosporine, and mycophenolate mofetil in combination treatment to induce a steroid or IVIG or SCIG sparing effect.
Got it. One of the things the guideline emphasized was the importance of looking for an objective treatment response. What are some of the measures that you recommend we use?
Well, there are lots of outcome scales, and there are impairment scales and disability scales. And what we recommended, as I was explaining a little bit earlier, is that you should have improvement on one impairment scale and on one disability scale. Impairment scales, there is the MRC sum score, there is hand grip testing. For disability, there are lots of different scales. The most useful, we think, is the IRODS, which is a rash-based scale, but there are many others. And you should use the one that has been validated, that works well, and that you have experience with.
Wonderful. Thank you. As we kind of reflect back and look over the guideline, I have to say, Dr. Vandenberg, I really appreciate this guideline. I find it clear, easy to reference, with the rationale and supportive evidence explained. Summarized for our audience, in my review, it looks like the major changes in diagnostic approach include 1, replacement of the label of atypical CIDP with better characterized CIDP variants. 2, we have a simplification of the levels of diagnostic certainty from 3 levels to 2 levels, CIDP and possible CIDP, with deletion of the label definite. And 3, we have inclusion of sensory conduction abnormalities in the definition of CIDP and some of its relevant variants. Looking ahead in the years to come, what aspects of diagnosis and management are identified as needing future research?
The pathophysiology of typical CIDP and its variants remains poorly understood. Further research is certainly needed looking for immune mechanisms. And a good example is the relatively recent finding of these nodal-paranodal IgG4 antibodies. But cellular immunity may play a role also. So research is ongoing, and hopefully this will lead to results, to new insights in the pathophysiology. But the other thing is that although we do have very effective treatments, they are not optimal. There are side effects, especially for corticosteroids. Then for IVIG, this is an expensive treatment, and more we are confronted to shortage of this drug, which has to be given over very long periods of time. Now, research into combination treatments should be done, and new drugs should be found and developed. And these new treatment avenues will indeed depend on new insights into the pathophysiology of the various forms of CIDP.
Great. Well, I look forward to our understanding as a field continuing to advance. Is there a plan to update the guideline again in any particular focus areas?
Well, what we wrote in the second revision is that it should be in 5 years. 10 years is probably too long.
Fair game. I look forward to it. And we'll continue to teach and use the current set now that we have it. Dr. Vandenberg, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today. Thanks for educating us about CIDP and sharing some of the highlights of the updated guideline.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.